The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi guys, I'm May and welcome to the second season of Phenomenal and Asian, a podcast aimed to redefine the Asian stereotype and share inspirational stories of those doing phenomenal things. This week's Phenomenal Asian is Howard Watt, a partner at one of the leading law firms. Howard and I bonded over the fact that we both pleased our Asian parents by choosing traditional and stable career paths, unlike our siblings. But this didn't stop us from discovering and going after what we were truly passionate about. Howard is now an incredibly successful partner, specializing in venture capital transactions, and I left accountancy to go start my own company. Unfortunately, we did have some technical issues when recording this episode, so it is a little shorter than normal, but it's still amazing, and I hope you enjoy.
It's funny that you picked up on the accent, because a lot of people do, because it's so kind of, if I can say this, bastardized from a bunch of different places now, and it picks up a bunch of different influences, and as a result, you can't really tell how it originated, and what, you know, what it's just like an eclectic mix of things that I think I've just sort of picked up, almost unconsciously. But in terms of originally where it's from, and as soon as I say this, a lot of people start to say, "Oh, I can hear it now underneath." I was actually born in Sunderland in the northeast. And then very rapidly moved to Newcastle. So I don't remember any time in Sunderland. So I think we moved when I was, you know, very, very young. And then I grew up basically in Newcastle, which is, you know, pretty much the same from an accent perspective, but very much not the same from a footballing perspective.
And so, I love that.
Yeah.
I went to Newcastle uni. So I think I kind of can hear.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Okay. Well, then you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. So I grew up in Newcastle. So I did actually have the very, very strong Geordie accent. And I think the first time that I started to lose that and the accent, I guess, started to change was when, you know, my parents, typical Asian parents, sent me to a private school in Newcastle. And I just got relentlessly bullied for my accent, because obviously they all talked in a slightly more, you know, posh way, I suppose is the best way of putting it, or well spoken. Yeah. Whereas I was coming in with this really, really strong accent. And so I just remember sort of being made fun of in terms of the way I talked, and it sort of being a conscious thing in my head. And, you know, bear in mind, I was like 7 years old, 8 years old at this time. And I do have this very distinct memory of being really confused as to why they thought this was so funny that I would sort of pronounce words differently. Even back then it was a kind of so maybe I should be speaking differently. And I think even subconsciously at that stage, I started to think about adjusting the intonation of the way that I spoke.
Has anyone ever got it right?
No, they haven't. I've had so many wrong answers. It's unbelievable. I've had Canadian, Australian, New Zealand, American, Scouse. I've even had, you know, I've had every conceivable suggestion under the sun, but nobody hits it right on the head.
And like going back to like, you know, Newcastle, do you think it was more the accent, or did you actually stand out because you were maybe the only Asian person in Newcastle, I'm guessing?
I think honestly, and this is sort of goes a little bit not against, I guess, the subject that we're talking about, but it's not been something that's stood out to me in a really big way, or not something that affected me in a really big way, is probably a better way of putting it. Because although looking back and thinking back, I was almost certainly the only kind of Chinese kid in my school and in my class, you know, my parents, as typical Asian parents are, always used to just, you know, on the weekends or on the evenings, bring you to other Chinese families' houses, right? So you had all this exposure to other Chinese families and other Chinese kids. So you wouldn't feel like, oh, I look so different, and why do I look so different, and there's nobody else here around me.
Right.
You would all, you have your kind of fair share of, okay, so we're seeing this Chinese family and their Chinese kids, and this Chinese family and their Chinese kids. And then when you go to school and don't see them, it doesn't feel like such a weird thing. You just sort of think, okay, so there are a bunch of different people around, and some of them look like me and some of them don't. And it never really, I don't think I really ever sort of connected the dots all that well as far as the kind of me being noticeably different from other people, because I didn't, you know, born in the UK, I never had kind of the strong accent or anything that would, I suppose, stereotypically give me away as Chinese, right? And so aside from like a really good use of chopsticks, and that is actually one of my earliest memories, I think, of being Chinese as opposed to non-Chinese or Caucasian or whatever you call it, is that we did something in the primary school I was in, so this would have been kind of age 5 or 6, where they were talking about I think it probably was Chinese New Year or something, and they did sort of a game where people had to like pick up little pegs using a pair of chopsticks. And obviously when it came to me, I was just there like just merrily just while everyone's there sort of struggling to even grip the chopsticks and stuff. And I think that was my first sort of awareness of, okay, so there's something that I can do that other people have trouble doing, and why is that? And then you sort of connect it to the race thing. But other than that, I'll be honest, there wasn't really anything that kind of...
That's great though.
Yeah, I mean, it is good. But then on the flip side, again, when I think back to it, I got bullied, you know, the same way as everybody else did. You know, I had the kind of, you know, the chinky chonky Chinaman jokes and all of those sort of things. And I can't tell why my reaction to it wasn't stronger and wasn't more visceral. I think if I try to think about it, it feels to me as if it's because, you know, and before I went to the private school, I went to like a pretty rough state primary, and you know, the teachers basically told my parents they had to get me out of there. But I went to a pretty rough state primary. And in that state primary, you know, everybody got bullied, right? Everybody got bullied for one thing or the other. Everyone was always getting in fights and stuff. So it never seemed as if I was targeted. It just seemed like, okay, so this is my thing, right? This guy's thing is because he's fat. This guy's thing is because he's quiet. My thing is because I look different, right? And so it was never I'm being specifically targeted as much as I'm being bullied for whatever it is that I look or appear different from other people. But that was no different from somebody who was, you know, a little bit quieter, or somebody who was a bit overweight, or someone who had a stutter or whatever. You know, people used to make fun of one of my best friends who had ginger hair for having ginger hair. So, you know, it didn't occur to me that it was sort of linked to race. And I think I would say that's in a good way probably stuck with me, in the sense that I don't feel it's ever really been that big of a burden for me, if that kind of makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. And I wonder whether if you were educated now in terms of racial abuse, that you would take it more personally, whereas as a child you did just kind of ignore it, and you were naive about it in a good way, and it didn't like affect your upbringing or childhood.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's I mean, it's interesting in sort of the current climate, I guess, in the almost, I kind of take almost like the Morgan Freeman approach to the sort of the racism thing, which is that how do you stop it is you stop talking about it, right? You kind of get on with things, and you try not to make it such a big thing. And in a way, I suppose that suggests, there's a suggestion there that's how consciously or subconsciously things went for me, is that I never picked up on it as something that was directly linked to my race. And as a result, I didn't grow up with that thought that when people say these things to me, it's like a discriminatory thing, if you know what I mean. I didn't see it any different from somebody who was a bully who wanted to make fun of somebody would say, okay, that person's fat, or that person's short, or that person's, you know, ugly, or whatever it is that they want to pick up on. And my thing is, oh, so you're Chinese, that means your eyes look funny.
Yeah, it kind of seemed like the less of the evil.
Yeah, you were like, I'll take that. Exactly. And I do remember, you know, getting angry at some of those things, but then kind of checking myself and wondering why I was angry, if that made sense. Because when someone does the thing with the eyes, you know, the pointing of the eyes, make your eyes look slanty, it's not that funny. it doesn't hurt. It doesn't make you feel bad about the shape of your eyes. You know, it didn't, none of that triggered anything in me, if that makes sense. And I'm not really, I can't really grasp why it didn't, but I'm glad it didn't, if that makes sense.
I mean, for me, it just doesn't make sense. Asian eyes aren't even like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, so I guess culture-wise, you was a very kind of Asian household and, you know, you ate Asian food and like, did your parents kind of instill that Asian culture?
Yeah. So, I mean, within the household, it was so stereotypically Asian.
I imagine
everything I say, there's just going to be, you know, nodding of heads across the land for everybody who's listening to this podcast, because, you know, rice with every meal, right? White rice with every meal. You know, there was always an endless supply of ramen noodles that were in the endless supply of those. And, you know, everything else I think that's fairly stereotypical for an Asian family is that everything is cooked in a Chinese way. So even if it was like English food, it would be cooked, it would be stir fried, or it would be kind of, you know, sort of mixed together and stir fried with some kind of.
Always an egg. There's always an egg involved. I don't know why.
Yeah, there wasn't as much egg in ours, but there was just always, you know, everything was just, if it's whatever meat it was, you stick a veg with it and then you stir fry it with some soy sauce and then bang, that's your dish. And then you add a side of white rice and and off you go. And so we never had, you know, so there are some things that are and remain slightly foreign to me, which is, you know, things like your Sunday roasts and your you know, fish Friday and stuff like that. I never understood any of those things, and I never thought like, you know, so for me now, like, a roast is a real kind of like, ooh, we're having a roast, where for a lot of people it's like, yeah, we did this like every Sunday we're growing up. So it's you know, whereas for people like you and me, it's probably more like, oh, we had rice every day. So now it's kind of a case of, I just don't want any more rice ever. I just don't want like a side of white rice. I'm just sick. It's completely sick of it. So yeah, very, very stereotypical Asian culture within the household. You know, they were quite tiger parenty, my parents, as far as working hard. And, you know, it was the Asian trifecta, right? It was like, you'll be a doctor, a lawyer, or accountant. That was the thing, right? So those are kind of my choices in life, and I ended up with option two. So
yeah, the choices that your parents gave you, actually did enjoy one of the three.
Exactly.
So I became an accountant.
There you go.
Number three, and absolutely hated it. Worked for PwC for like 4 years. And then I quit, and now I own my own startup. So totally know what you mean. And the same with me and my brothers. I'm the last, so I'm the third. And my brother did medicine and quit. The second one, I don't even know what he studied. I think he studied business or something. And so all of their hopes were pinned on me. So I had to go down the road and just get the certificate on the hanging seal.
And then you did it for a few years, and then hopefully they kind of calmed down and gradually acknowledge that you are like 1% of an adult, and that you can make 1% of your own decisions, and then that kind of allows you a little bit of freedom, I suppose. But
and what about your like, I'm always interested about like your parents. How did they come to the UK?
My dad is from mainland China. He talks in great tones about how he was raised on a pig farm in rural China. My mom got a degree from, she came over and she was a teacher in Hong Kong, and then she came over and she did her degree with the Open University and became kind of like a businesswoman. Mm-hmm. And she at one point had a travel agency that sort of specialized in assisting people from Hong Kong and China come and immigrate into the UK. And so that was one of the big things that she did. And then off the back of that, she also started a business with a partner of hers, which was sort of the first incarnation of Chinese fast food outlet mall type of, you know, food court places, as opposed to your, you know, your stereotypical Chinese takeaway, which, you know, I think they both had their time working in a Chinese takeaway when they first moved to the UK before we were born, and even in the first couple of years of when we were born. But then later on, when she did set this up, and it was called Wok and Roll, which is just a fantastic.
Oh, no way.
And it was in the Metro Center in Newcastle. And it was ridiculously popular. I mean, it was more popular than Burger King. It was more popular than KFC. It had people queuing out the entire food court to go there. And I worked there a couple of summers, and it was great, and it was incredibly popular, and it was a really, really good idea. And it was really kind of the early inception of that idea, because nobody ever really did that before. And then I think some people tried to, you know, somebody came to her one day with an offer to franchise it into what became known as Singapore Sam's. And then I don't think that really took off anywhere. And then since then, I guess there have been various sort of spin-off versions like Walk to Walk and things like that. But the big, I mean, you know, the big success story of somebody trying to do that is Panda Express in the US, right?
Actually, my parents are kind of similar. And my dad came over here to go to uni. And he was actually an engineer as well. But then basically he started like Chinese takeaways because actually he realized he could earn more money doing that. And my mum started like a shop selling kind of importing oriental goods. But it was just like, actually they were also entrepreneurial. Do you know what I mean? Like kind of finding pockets of opportunity, whether that's food or goods
definitely. I think there's I've got a huge amount of respect for what they did. In our generation, the options are just, you know, widely out there. You can learn anything you want. You can find anything you want. You know, we're talking about for people that can digest this, pre-internet times, when, you know, they had like a phone book and a landline, and they had to just go out and kind of do all of this stuff themselves. So I've got a huge amount of respect for what they managed to do and what they managed to achieve.
And like, do they ever say to you that you know, oh god, we worked hard, or did they actually think that your generation, it's hard for them?
I don't think they've ever been that hard on me, as far as, you know, saying, reminding me of, oh, we had to do this and we had to do that. I think they've only ever referred to that in a humorous way more than anything else, just kind of like, oh, you know, back in our day we never had this and that sort of thing. But they've never been all that harsh with it. I will give them a huge amount of credit in that they were really strict on us in terms of the whole kind of tiger parent education side of things, but never on the cultural side of things. So there have been occasions where, you know, my dad would have hinted at marrying a Chinese girl and that sort of thing, but there was never a sort of like never any kind of even a hint of twisting my arm to try and get me to do that. It was, I think there was the very much an acknowledgement in their minds that they had me born and raised in a Western society, and they had to acknowledge that comes with it, that I'll be brought up with those kind of influences. So, you know, there's only ever times when little pockets of time when I was single that my dad would say, well, you know, there's your cousin's having a wedding and they have these, you know, these, whatever they call it, matching up parties or whatever they have in Hong Kong, where they kind of, what sounds like they just bring along all the single people and stick them in the room. And I was really kind of like, that sounds like the last thing that I want to do.
So you said that you kind of studied abroad in Europe, and then talk us, I guess, kind of up to being, you know, a lawyer, and how did you
So I studied law at Durham, and so I could take my washing back home to my mum. And then after I did the exchange year and came back and graduated, the path into law is already sort of to some extent set in stone a little bit, in that the year before I went abroad, I'd already sort of signed up for kind of vacation schemes. And as soon as you do a vacation scheme with a firm, you increase your likelihoods of getting a training contract with that firm. And that was a firm based down in London called Olswang, which has since merged with a couple of other law firms to become what's now known as CMS Cameron Nabarro Olswang or something like that. And so I ended up doing a training contract there qualifying as a lawyer in 2006, and then moved firms a couple of times, and then ended up going kind of one of the well-trodden paths of being a lawyer is you either stay and you become a partner, or you go in-house and you work in-house for a company and you no longer have to do timesheets and billable hours and all that sort of thing. And so I did that about 5 years qualified. I moved to Fidelity, the asset management company. And I ended up working in-house there for about 6 years. And it was actually there that I actually just fell into venture capital, because that's where they sat my desk, because they didn't really have a desk. So they stuck me in with the venture capital team you know, as my boss put it, he was like, you guys are all the same age and you'll probably hit it off, and we don't have a desk for you. So get yourself in with those guys. So I ended up sitting in there and just learned a huge amount from sitting with those guys. And that's where I picked up VC And that really kind of changed, I think, the trajectory of what I do, because I didn't tremendously enjoy being a generalist corporate lawyer before that. But as soon as I picked up VC, I really kind of took to it and really liked it. And that's kind of continued to this day. So, you know, that's been the path.
You know, when you went into that and just even you becoming a lawyer and doing your previous roles, were there many Asians around you, like, I guess, in terms of some of the companies that you've worked in?
I certainly can remember coming across a lot of Asians. I don't think there's necessarily underrepresentation in the industry, because there are some clients that I have that are Asian investment funds. So their entire team, you know, all of the investment principals, their in-house lawyers, or, you know, pretty much all of their team is Asian, and their LPs are probably Asian as well, and based out of Asia. And so there's definitely not underrepresentation. Whether or not there's probably a legitimate argument to say there's a little bit of overrepresentation.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah.
At PwC, there were a lot more Asians, you know, in other industries.
Well, I think what we have to admit is the stereotypical Asian thing of money, right? So it's like, you think of, as soon as there's a thing that's successful and is making money, you better believe the Asians are going to be like, oh, we're interested. And then if you look at the kind of the roots of the tech ecosystem as a whole is really kind of in Silicon Valley in the US. And that's, you know, that's West Coast, and that's sort of, you know, San Francisco, which has an enormous, enormous Asian population. And so I think there's a number of different influences, which mean it's not surprising to see quite a lot of Asians represented in the tech community, which is great. And so it never occurs to me, or never becomes a thing where I sort of think I'm the only Asian kicking about, or I'm the only Asian who's doing this or in this ecosystem or involved with this sort of thing. But I think, you know, the thing that I think, you know, when we spoke about this podcast originally, the thing that really sprung to mind is something that is more on the cultural side of things, because somewhere I do think, and have always thought and continue to think, there is massive underrepresentation is culturally. So, you know, film and TV and those aspects of society, I think there's a massive underrepresentation of Asians, and it's improving, I think, slowly, but it's nowhere near what I would call a healthy level of representation, because it's still very stereotypical, right? So if I was to think of Fresh Off the Boat, the sitcom, right? That kind of almost leans into the stereotypes for humorous purposes, and it's great, and it's, you know, I like that the show even exists, but in some ways I kind of think that's just going to perpetuate those sort of stereotypes and never have Asians really seen as anything outside of what they've traditionally been seen as, and that I think that's the thing that needs to be broken free from at sometimes. And, you know, going deeper into that, in the past, there've been obviously, you know, when I speak about the period of time of me growing up and being in London and eventually kind of, you know, getting girlfriends and getting married and that sort of thing, that definitely was somewhere where I sort of experienced being Asian as being a negative or kind of a drawback, in the sense that, you know, nobody pictures. No, you know, you ask any kind of, I suppose, Western or Caucasian girl or even Asian, given your experience, to sort of picture or describe or identify their dream guy or their ideal guy. Nobody's going to pick an Asian, right? Nobody is going to say, oh, they're 6 foot tall and they do this and they're into sports and they're Chinese. You know, nobody would ever come up with that answer. And I think the reason for that is because there aren't those kind of figures in film and TV.
Yeah.
So you're never going to be like, you know, you're never going to have your Denzel Washingtons or your kind of, you know, your Brad Pitts that kind of cover the other different races, where there's somebody that they can look at and go, wow, that guy's cool, or that guy's a man, or, you know, I can picture myself as somebody who's got that kind of, you know, that charisma and that coolness. But no, you have your Jet Lis with the strong accent and they do karate, and I mean, even Bruce Lee, right, who's always going to be kind of the leading light on the Asian front. I don't think there was ever a thing where he was really sort of painted out as a romantic leading man character. His was all about the kind of the kung fu and the karate, right? So it's hard break free of that, and I think it's an ongoing thing, and it will probably take a long time to really break out of that. But, you know, the day that we start to see regular mainstream Chinese male actors as leading men would be a really, really nice thing to see.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's Phenomenal and Asian podcast. I'll be releasing new episodes every week, and if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you follow us on Instagram at phenomenal.asian for all the latest updates.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.